Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The headline number on that gross domestic product report this morning was really good. The economy grew at a rate of almost 6% the end of last year. The details, though, are a little more nuanced. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 29th of January, and I am glad to have you here. You take an economy that is stuck as long as ours has been stuck, and almost any increase in growth is a good thing. 5.7% for the last quarter of 2009 is flat out amazing, the best in 6 years. But, well, here's John Dimsdale.
The Commerce Department says the biggest chunk of last quarter's growth came from inventory replacement. Starting in 2008, retailers and wholesalers were too skittish about the economy to replenish their slowly emptying shelves. But by last summer, stockpiles had fallen enough to generate some replacement orders, so factories geared up. David Malpass with Ensema Global says shelves are full again, but customers aren't buying yet.
People are worried about their jobs, holding back on their purchases, and so we won't be able to keep growing at a 5% rate because the goods and services would just pile up.
There is one part of last quarter's growth that looks more sustainable.
We're seeing a real surge in exports.
David Huther, chief economist for the National Association of Manufacturers, says exports grew by 28% thanks to orders from Europe and Asia.
The global economy is picking up. The dollar is competitive, about 10% below its long-term average, and we're seeing the benefits from that.
Huther says that's the strongest export growth in 30 years. Still, exports aren't enough to improve the job picture anytime soon.
The jobs hole is so deep, we need about 10.5 million jobs just to get back to the pre-recession unemployment level.
Josh Bivens is with the Economic Policy Institute.
It would take about 4 years of growth at 5.7% to get there.
Bivens says the economy won't grow anywhere close to that without more government stimulus. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
10.5 million new jobs, Josh Bivens just said, and that's only to break even. One of President Obama's plans to fix that does seem to be getting some support from both political parties. The White House wants an employment tax credit for small businesses, a $5,000 credit on your taxes for every net new employee that's brought on this year. And the White House would help companies cover the cost of Social Security taxes if they give pay increases. Sounds promising. We asked Marketplace Jeremy Hobson whether it might actually work.
Imagine you own a small chain of Mexican restaurants and have a total of 100 employees. Demand's been down since the recession began, and you've laid off 20 people. You'd like to hire some back so you can keep your restaurants open later and get the chips and salsa to your customers faster. Will $5,000 per employee convince you that now's the time to hire?
It might not convince you to hire somebody who's going to be paid 100 grand. But it certainly will have a big effect for hiring a low-wage worker.
That's John Bishop, a professor of human resource studies at Cornell. He points to a similar tax credit from the late 70s.
Employment had not been growing in the 6 months prior to the start of this tax credit, and it stopped growing as soon as the tax credit was over.
He says the tax credit being proposed by the Obama administration could cut the unemployment rate by 2 percentage points. The administration's plan would give a company credits for up to 100 workers to try to ensure a focus on small businesses. Still, not all small business owners are sure it'll work. David Clinton, who runs an architecture firm in North Carolina, says $5,000 per employee won't speed up his hiring.
It's too small, and we need to see the nation build more buildings in order for us to hire architects to design them.
In other words, it all comes down to consumer demand, and tax credit or no tax credit, some employers still aren't convinced it'll be there. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Changing gears here just for a bit. The football pickings this weekend are kind of slim, to be honest with you. Just the Pro Bowl game, the NFL's All-Star Show, is Sunday in Miami. It's the first time in 30 years the game hasn't been played out in Hawaii. It's also the first time the Pro Bowl is being played before the Super Bowl instead of after. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports now that the change in game plan has produced a hiccup or two.
Playing the Pro Bowl used to be a nice perk for NFL players and their families, a little island vacation after a bruising season of football. To some players, though, this year's Pro Bowl is more like an inconvenient warm-up act to the Super Bowl. More than 30 of the players originally picked for the game have opted not to play this Sunday, citing injuries or, well, more important commitments like preparing for the Super Bowl. David Carter, who runs USC's Sports Business Institute, says the NFL is simply trying to stage their all-star game while fans still have football on the brain.
It is, however, causing quite a bit of problems with teams and players and other personnel for whom the week before the Super Bowl is already busy enough.
The NFL Players Association contends the game change is all about money, but an NFL spokesman said today the Pro Bowl's always been a money loser and probably will be this year as well. It doesn't help that the A-list players originally selected for the game still get paid tens of thousands, whether they end up opting out or not. But Dan Kaplan, finance editor at Sports Business Journal, thinks this Pro Bowl switcheroo may end up a winner.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever done a segment on the Pro Bowl before?
Frankly, no. And that's Kaplan's point.
The Pro Bowl has never been more talked about than it is now, and they've already said they're going to set an attendance record for the game on Sunday night.
TV viewership may be another issue, though. Turns out the Pro Bowl will compete against the Grammy Awards that evening. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Grammys, Pro Bowl, I don't know. No All-Stars at all on Wall Street today, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This morning's report on gross domestic product was greeted with mixed emotions at the White House. Clearly, a 5.7% increase in GDP is a positive sign. But Christina Romer, the head of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, said we ought not read too much into just a single report. We will read the tea leaves of the week on Wall Street and beyond with our regulars Heidi Moore. She writes for The Big Money. And making a special appearance this week from the World Economic Forum in Davos, it's Felix Salmon. He blogs for Reuters. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
It's good to be here.
Not only, Felix, are you in Davos, many, many other people are, including Lawrence Summers, one of the president's chief economic advisors, said this morning, hey, you know, 5.7%, that's pretty good, but nothing to raise the roof about. What do you think? What's the buzz?
I don't think anyone's buzzing about the U.S. GDP numbers, that's right. So if Larry said that the GDP is nothing to write home about, he's probably right because it's mostly inventories, and we'll have to wait and see if this kind of pace can be sustained. I suspect that it can't. Most of the Davosians are far too busy patting each other on the back and trying to save the world.
All right, well, we'll get to the schmoozing and saving the world part in a second. Heidi, your thoughts on this GDP thing?
Well, I think it's obviously excellent news just because we've been so battered and beaten down for so long that it's nice to see something. But there are reservations, as Felix said, and as the people in Davos don't care about. There's, you know, the issue of what we're doing with interest rates, which eventually are going to have to rise. There's the issue of the continuing stimulus, the bailouts, elections. All of these things will weigh on the growth of the economy. And, of course, we have that giant mountain of our own down which we are skiing, which is jobs.
You really want to be in Davos, right, with that skiing analogy? I mean, you want to be there.
I'm a little jealous. Yeah, I'm a little jealous.
I don't blame you. All right, well, let's talk jobs for just a second before we get to the schmoozing thing. How exactly is the president, for all of his laser-like focus on the economy and jobs, how's he going to create jobs? I mean, what's the mechanism?
That's an excellent question, and I think only he really knows. But there was a promising note this week in that he proposed some money for high-speed rail. It's not nearly enough. I think it's about $8 billion, but it's a start, and so you'll need people to build those high-speed rail lines all across the country. And then we'll have to see what comes next.
Of course, infrastructure investment is an extremely expensive way of creating jobs. It costs a good $200,000 per job. I would much rather see the president putting money into things like arts subsidies where you can get jobs for $20,000.
Well, let me try to read between the lines here for just a second. Felix, clearly you're skeptical. And Heidi, I'll be honest, subjectively, you're a little more downbeat than you have been on this program in the past. Are you not feeling the love from the president's economic plan?
It's really a tough problem to solve. You have, you know, the greatest minds of our generation working on this for months and months, for years, and they're still not making a dent in the jobs number. And so, you know, just from past history, I think we really have to reserve judgment about how successful any program would be. And as Felix said, infrastructure investment and rail is very expensive, and $8 billion doesn't even get us started.
All right. Well, all of that substantive stuff in the past. Now, Felix Davos, I've been reading your posts and your comments so far here on the show. You're clearly skeptical about this thing, but it must do some larger good, or else it couldn't possibly be sustainable, this World Economic Forum thing.
Oh, it does larger bad, I think. What happens is that everyone tells each other that they're geniuses and they're the brightest minds of their generation and that they can save the world and they can generally, you know, come down to planet Earth from their alpine retreat and save the world once they return to it. And that kind of hubris is exactly what caused the global economic crisis. And so now they're maybe a tiny little bit more modest than they were before, but this afternoon, I was still listening to Bill Gates talking about how he's going to single-handedly end world hunger. You know, they love that kind of thing over here.
Heidi, from the safe confines of our studios in New York, not in Davos, what do you think about this whole World Economic Forum?
It's kind of like recess for people who like to think, and so it gets the wiggles out, you know, and so then they can get back to the classroom and actually do something useful. There is a social benefit in at least having people talking, even if it goes nowhere.
Felix, here's the put-up-or-shut-up question. You going back next year?
If I can get the right color badge.
It's all about the badges?
Depending on what color badge you get, you either get the full-on VIP treatment or else you're just third-class scum.
Felix Salmon via the World Economic Forum in Davos. Heidi Moore via our phone booth in New York City. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.
The White House is set to release its fiscal year 2011 budget plan bright and early Monday morning. Obviously, various and sundry government agencies are hoping to protect their particular pieces of turf. NASA is worried about the skies. The president is expected to kill the plan his predecessor came up with to put Americans back on the moon. Thousands of high-tech jobs hang in the balance, as does the business model for U.S. space policy. From KUER in Salt Lake City, Jenny Brundine reports.
Last fall, the future of the nation's space policy seemed clear. Sure, the space shuttle program was ending, but there was a new plan in place, not just to get astronauts up to the International Space Station, but to send them back to the moon and beyond.
T-minus 10, 9, 8.
That plan relied on a new rocket called the Ares 1. Its test launch at the Kennedy Space Center in October was a success.
Ignition and liftoff of Ares 1X.
So far, NASA has sunk about $3.5 billion into Ares. Thousands of NASA employees and private contractors work on the rocket in states like Florida, Ohio, and California.
Now passing Mach 2. Vehicle now 10 miles out.
But as the recession drags on, it seems NASA won't get the billions it needs to complete the project. President Obama will scrap the plan to send Americans to the moon, and Ares could be abandoned. That's bad news for aerospace company ATK, one of Utah's largest employers. It builds the boosters for the Ares 1 rocket. ATK spokesman George Torres says future jobs at the company depend on the president's vision for space exploration.
It comes down to, are we going to stay in low Earth orbit, which is, you know, the space station, or are we going to do true exploration, which could be Mars or asteroid or the moon or any number of things.
The president's budget is expected to reveal a new strategy, one that relies on private companies to send cargo and astronauts to the International Space Station.
When NASA tries to be an operator of transportation services, they're not playing to their strength.
Jeff Grayson is president and CEO of X-Corp Aerospace and a member of the panel that advised Obama on the future of American spaceflight. He thinks using private companies for shorter flights will free up NASA to focus on deep space research.
We are opening up, or should be opening up, new frontiers for humanity. And you don't do that going around and around in low Earth orbit. That's not the same as exploration.
No companies have launched their spacecraft into orbit yet. Several say they'll be ready soon, like SpaceX, owned by the multimillionaire founder of PayPal. But NASA backers ask this question: what if the U.S. abandons the Ares rocket and private companies can't launch their spacecraft successfully? U.S. Congressman Rob Bishop says it could damage the nation's aerospace industry for decades to come.
The problem is there are a lot of people who think these jobs are simply like a spigot you can turn on and off. Once you cut the production lines, the engineers and the technical people leave, and you cannot just simply bring them all back.
Bishop hopes Obama's budget doesn't signal the final frontier just yet. Any shift in NASA's mission is likely to face stiff opposition from Congress. From Salt Lake City, I'm Jenny Brendine for Marketplace.
Coming up, Davos After Dark.
Many a banker and CEO have sang with me and danced, and even people danced on the piano years ago.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials dropped 53 points this Friday at the end of January. That's a 0.5%, closed to 10,067. The NASDAQ off 31 points, nearly 1.5%, 2147 at the bell there. The S&P 500 ticked down 10 points, almost 1%, finished at 1,073. For the week, the Dow drained off 1.1%. The NASDAQ unplugged 2.6%. The S&P 500 fell 1.7%. Tech stocks registered more big declines today. Microsoft and Apple each lost more than 3%. Intel dropped 2.2%. Hewlett-Packard sank 1.5% today. Amazon came out with strong quarterly earnings and said it's going to buy back $2 billion worth of its own stock, but the e-tailer still clicked down 0.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.59%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for December. Organizations in the renewable energy, energy efficiency, and environmental arenas launch Clean Energy Week with a news conference at the National Press Club. And it runs right over Valentine's Day. February is American Heart Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Heidi Moore made a good point a couple of minutes ago. Say what you will about the World Economic Forum, about it being an out-of-touch gathering of the global elite, and a lot of people, including Felix, have said exactly that. But there is this to consider. A couple of days in Davos can be a pretty good break from the regular grind. That is true for the journalists covering it. It's true for the politicians who are there, and it is true for the CEOs who get to spend some time thinking about where their companies and the global economy go from here. I asked Indra Nooyi that question the other day. She's the CEO of Pepsi. She's at Davos. And her answer was that those companies and the CEOs have to redefine a fundamental measurement of how companies work, profit and loss, or P&L.
I think the first thing that every CEO has to accept that we are in business to serve the stakeholder. And the stakeholder is, in fact, multifaceted, has different interests, represents different constituencies. And we have to make sure that our new P&L actually says revenue, less cost of goods sold, less costs to society. and that's your real profit. And if we start with that as the P&L, and we start with the notion of the stakeholder and not the shareholder, the way in which corporations act and the way they're perceived will all change.
That's no small job, given that the attitude in the broader public toward corporations these days is not all that positive.
You know, that's unfortunate, because I think the public perception of corporations and CEOs is worse than reality, because I interface with a lot of CEOs, and I tell you, a lot of the CEOs I interface with have, you know, real desire to do good for society, have a real desire to make change that's positive, want to help governments address issues. I think what we do is we start with this distrust, and therefore we don't bring out the best in people. You know, my dad would always say, assume positive intent. I think the time has come to assume positive intent on both sides, and let's see what happens going forward.
That's tough, though, because corporations are obliged to do the best for their shareholders. They're obliged to maximize their profit. The public sees that, and they say, ah, they're just out for themselves and to make money. And what about the little guy?
I think that's the old definition of the corporation. I think the new corporation is, in fact, thinking stakeholders and not just shareholders, because they all look at the financial crisis. And I think the financial crisis came about because there was a maniacal focus on the shareholder. And everybody's now got a dose of religion and realizes that a maniacal focus on the shareholder will hit you up against a wall. So people are now beginning to embrace, faster than you'd ever imagine, that the stakeholder is the right person to focus on, because companies can do well long term, only the societies in which they operate also do well.
Do you feel maligned at all by the financial crisis, you as a CEO of a big corporation?
Not really. I think people have recognized that many of the Main Street companies, in fact, kept operating through the financial crisis and performed very well through the crisis, and they really were not part of the crisis. But at the end of the day, we need a successful, thriving Wall Street to access financing and for companies to grow and function. And so it's critically important Wall Street comes back as quickly as possible, provides the capital for companies to keep growing, but let's get on with life, because we cannot afford to stay in this state of suspended animation much too long.
Do me a favor and give me, would you, the mood of Davos this year as compared to the other times you've been there?
Well, I tell you, the mood in Davos prior to last year was quite optimistic. Last year, I think, was the turning point. Everybody came here to talk about the recession, the downturn, the meltdown of the financial system. This time around, the conversation is centered exclusively on the future, creating jobs, capitalism 2.0, the role of global cooperation, the role of CEOs, executive compensation, values behind capitalism. I think the mood is more forward-looking, but clearly one where people are confused as to who's going to actually take the action.
Indra Nooyi, she's the CEO of PepsiCo. We reached her at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Mrs. Nooyi, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kai. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
When the folks at Davos knock off for the day, when the workshops on the future of capitalism are all done, there is no shortage of other things to do. The nightlife there goes on into the wee small hours of the morning. Christopher Worth headed for some of the piano bars in town.
Walk through the snow-covered streets, and it seems that at every turn, there's a lounge with someone poised above the ivories. And all around, patrons are chinking glasses and passing out business cards. And then there's the lounge at the Hotel Europe, one of the nicer hotels in town, and a magnet for Davos attendees.
Let's do a good sexy song right now. It's a song from Bill Withers.
Barry Colson lives in Canada, but he's been coming to Davos for the past 17 years just to play during the World Economic Forum.
There is no other bar in town like this place. There is none. There are many a banker and CEO who have sang with me and danced, and even people danced on the piano years ago.
Colson says Peter Gabriel is known to sit at the bar, and even Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, showed up the other night. But with so many piano bars in town, I thought I'd go size up the competition. This was the scene just down the street. Aside from a small group trading stories about their wildest Davos moments, All the other tables are empty and no one is dancing. So I made my way back to where Coulson was just launching in to another number.
It's another tequila sunrise, staring slowly across the sky.
Coulson says the thing he likes about his bar is that, wealthy or not, if even for just one night, everyone is on the same level.
You know, whether it be a banker or a person that's just working at the hotel down the street, they all come up, they all sing, they all have a great time. You know, it's sort of a place where it's like Switzerland, it's very neutral.
Of course, in the morning, the bankers will go back to rubbing shoulders with world leaders, and everyone else will just be left with a bad hangover. In Davos, Switzerland, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
There is more from behind the scenes in Davos. No more bad music, though. It's on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
As we wrap things up on this Friday afternoon, let's take a moment to review not the major news of the week, but the items that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Eddie Hirsch, senior editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about a report that the most successful enterprise in Italy last year was the Mafia.
I'm supposed to be surprised by this.
Well, here's the thing. Italy's growth fell by 5%, but the Mafia ended up making a profit.
But the good news is that now all businesses that cater to, like, the mobster demographic are going to go through the roof, right? Tommy Gunn. Fedoras.
Overcoats.
Definitely invest in overcoats. Also fishes and cannoli.
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What's your story?
It's from Britain. Apparently because they've had such a cold winter this month, a Holiday Inn in Manchester, England, has a new service. It is a human bed warming service.
Are you sure that's a new service?
Yeah, exactly.
How does it work?
Pretty stupidly, I gotta say. But what they do is one of the employees of the hotel will dress in an all-in-one fleece sleeper suit, get in your bed for a little while, and leave. To me, this sort of sounds like Goldilocks mixed with a home invasion, you know?
What's wrong with, like, a human thermostat adjuster?
Amy Scott, New York Bureau Chief, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
A Chinese airline accidentally gave hundreds of passengers a huge discount.
Like, how huge?
Apparently you could buy a ticket for $2.90. And some of those tickets were first class.
This is because of, like, a computer glitch or something?
That's what the company says, but it is going to honor the tickets.
Well, that's nice of them.
I hope they have pretzels on the flight.
They will, but they'll cost $1,000.
There is oh so much more of what Rico and Brendan can do on their podcast. It is called the Dinner Party Download, and there's a link on our website, marketplace.org. And that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 53 points, 0.5%, closed at 10,067. NASDAQ off 31 points, nearly 1.5%. The S&P 500 ticked down 10 points, almost 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, $29 for a movie does seem like a lot, but if it comes with a cocktail waitress?
If it gets classified as a different experience, who knows if $29 is too much? That might be the bargain of the century.
No, I know. $29 is a lot. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.